A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the Arab League, which he describes as an organization that mostly surfaces in headlines when it's convening to criticize Israel, and he's wondering what it actually does the rest of the time. What is its purpose? What has it accomplished? And is there more to the story than periodic anti-Israel communiques? Most people couldn't name three things the Arab League has done.
Most people couldn't name two. And I say that as someone who's read the charter. The Arab League is simultaneously one of the most symbolically important multilateral organizations in the world and one of the most functionally disappointing. It's the General Motors of regional blocs, enormous brand recognition perpetually falling short of its own specs.
The General Motors of regional blocs. I'm going to let that one breathe for a moment.
It holds up. Founded with grand ambitions, kept alive by institutional inertia, and the fact that nobody can agree on what would replace it. The League was established in March 1945 in Cairo, six founding members, Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. Yemen joined a few months later. Today, it has 22 member states, though Syria's membership was suspended in 2011 after the civil war broke out and was only reinstated in 2023.
Reinstated with remarkably little fanfare, as I recall.
Because nobody wanted to talk about it. Assad showing up at the Jeddah summit last year was the diplomatic equivalent of someone returning to a dinner party after being asked to leave. Everyone just stared at their plates and resumed eating. But the founding itself is interesting. The British backed it heavily. Anthony Eden gave a speech in 1941 explicitly calling for Arab unity, and the British saw the League as a way to channel Arab nationalism into something they could manage.
Manage being the operative word. The British spent a century perfecting the art of creating institutions that look like self-determination, but function like imperial furniture.
The Alexandria Protocol of 1944 laid the groundwork, and the League's first Secretary General was an Egyptian, Abdul Rahman Azzam. He famously coined the phrase, quote, "This will be a war of extermination and a momentous massacre," referring to the prospect of a Jewish state in 1948. So the anti-Israel orientation was present at the creation.
Daniel's observation that criticizing Israel seems to be its primary function. It's not a modern development. It's basically in the DNA.
It's in the charter. Article 2 of the Arab League Pact lists the organization's purposes: strengthening relations among member states, coordinating political plans, safeguarding independence and sovereignty, and cooperating on economic, cultural, social, and health affairs. Notice what's not in there: collective defense, binding dispute resolution, any enforcement mechanism whatsoever. The charter explicitly says resolutions are binding only on states that accept them, which means every state has a built-in opt-out.
It's a club where dues are mandatory, but rules are optional.
That's the elevator pitch. And the dues are a problem in themselves. Multiple member states are perpetually in arrears. The League's budget is modest. It fluctuates, but we're talking roughly $100 to $120 million annually, which for 22 countries is pocket change. Compare that to the African Union, which has a larger budget despite representing generally poorer countries. The Arab League's headquarters in Tahrir Square in Cairo is this massive building that projects ambition, but the actual operational capacity is thin.
The building is the strategy.
I'd put that on a t-shirt. And it's not just a slogan, there's a real pattern here. The Arab League's primary output, in terms of volume, is resolutions. Thousands and thousands of resolutions. Most of them are non-binding statements of position. They express solidarity, they condemn, they affirm. The word affirming probably appears more times in League documents than any other verb.
If we're looking for concrete achievements, what's the best case? What would a defender of the League point to?
A fair question, and I want to be fair to the League because there are things worth noting. The Arab League Educational, Cultural, and Scientific Organization, ALEXO, has done genuinely useful work. Founded in 1970, it's basically the Arab world's UNESCO. It coordinates literacy programs, cultural preservation, translation initiatives. The League also created the Arab League Center for Translation, which translates hundreds of books between Arabic and other languages.
Translation is one of those unglamorous activities that actually builds civilizational infrastructure. Nobody writes headlines about it.
And the Arab League helped establish several specialized agencies: the Arab Monetary Fund, the Arab Fund for Economic and Social Development, the Arab Bank for Economic Development in Africa. These institutions have done real lending and development work. The Arab Fund alone has committed something like $35 billion in loans and grants since its founding.
$35 billion is not nothing.
It's not nothing. But here's the thing. Many of these agencies function essentially independently. They're under the League's umbrella, but the League itself doesn't coordinate them effectively. It's less a coherent system and more a collection of entities that share a logo.
Like a franchise operation where nobody's enforcing brand standards.
That's exactly the dynamic. Now, let's talk about the biggest economic initiative, the Greater Arab Free Trade Area, GAAFTA, launched in 1997, fully implemented by 2005. The idea was to eliminate tariffs on goods traded between member states. 17 of the 22 members joined, and it did reduce some tariffs.
I'm hearing a but approaching.
Inter-Arab trade remains abysmally low. Before GAFTA, inter-Arab trade was about 8% of total Arab trade. After GAFTA, it rose to maybe 10 or 11%. Compare that to the European Union, where intra-bloc trade is around 60%, or ASEAN, where it's about 25%. The Arab world trades with the rest of the world far more than it trades with itself.
The free trade area eliminated tariffs, but didn't eliminate the actual barriers to trade.
Because the real barriers aren't tariffs. They're non-tariff barriers. Customs procedures, regulatory differences, arbitrary border delays, political disputes that spill into commerce. You can eliminate a tariff with a signature. You can't eliminate a customs official who decides your truck sits at the border for 3 days because the country you're exporting from is in a diplomatic spat with the country you're importing to.
The League has no authority to overrule a member state's customs bureaucracy.
The League cannot compel a member state to do anything. Every decision requires consensus on substantive matters. Can you imagine trying to get 22 countries with radically different political systems, economic interests, and security concerns to reach consensus on anything consequential?
I can imagine it. And the image involves a room full of people nodding, while absolutely nothing changes.
That's the Arab League summit in a sentence. These summits happen annually in theory, less regularly in practice. They produce a final communique that is typically drafted before the leaders even arrive. The actual summit is a photo opportunity. The communique is negotiated at the foreign minister level weeks in advance.
The decision has already been made, and the summit is the press release.
With better catering. And here's where it gets interesting, the internal dynamics. Egypt has historically dominated the League. The headquarters is in Cairo. The Secretary General has almost always been Egyptian. There have been 8 secretaries, general, and 6 of them were Egyptian. The current one, Ahmed Abul Gait, is a former Egyptian foreign minister. This is not a coincidence. Egypt views the League as an instrument of its regional influence.
The other members accept this?
They tolerate it because the alternative, a league where someone else is dominant, or no league at all, is worse for them. Saudi Arabia uses the League when it's useful for Saudi purposes and ignores it when it's not. The Gulf states have their own sub-organization, the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is actually more functionally integrated than the Arab League. The GCC has a unified customs union, a common market, coordination on security. It's basically what the Arab League wishes it could be, but for 6 countries instead of 22.
The real regional cooperation happens in the smaller club, and the bigger club is the stage for political theater.
That's the pattern, and the League's most famous political initiative, the Arab Peace Initiative, illustrates both what's possible and what's broken. This was a Saudi proposal adopted by the Arab League at the Beirut summit in 2002. It offered Israel full normalization of relations with all Arab states in exchange for a full Israeli withdrawal to the 1967 lines, a just solution to the Palestinian refugee issue, and the establishment of a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital.
Which was significant. The entire Arab League collectively offering normalization was a conceptual breakthrough.
Yasser Arafat reportedly learned about it while the summit was happening and was furious because he hadn't been consulted, but the League endorsed it unanimously. And then what happened? The Second Intifada was raging. A Passover massacre in Netanyahu happened the same week as the summit, and the initiative got buried under violence. It was re-endorsed in 2007 at the Riyadh summit, and it technically remains the League's stated position, but it's been sitting on the shelf for over two decades.
Israel never formally responded to it.
Israel had a complicated relationship with it. Some Israeli officials saw it as a basis for negotiation. Others dismissed it as a take-it-or-leave-it diktat. The initiative says full withdrawal and a just solution to the refugee issue. It doesn't specify what just means, and that ambiguity is where the entire thing collapses on inspection. But the point is, the Arab League was capable of producing something strategically interesting. The problem was follow-through.
Follow-through requires an institution that can enforce its own decisions.
Which brings us back to the structural problem. The League has no enforcement mechanism. When Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990, the Arab League was paralyzed. It condemned the invasion, eventually, but the coalition that liberated Kuwait was American-led, not Arab League-led. When the Syrian civil war broke out, the League suspended Syria's membership and imposed sanctions, which was a significant move, but it had no ability to affect the course of the war itself. When Libya descended into chaos after 2011, the League recognized the Rebel Transitional Council, but again, the actual military intervention was NATO.
The pattern is, the League can issue a statement, it can suspend a membership, it can confer or withdraw legitimacy, but it cannot project power.
Legitimacy is its only real currency. And that's not nothing. In international relations, legitimacy matters. Being recognized or condemned by the Arab League affects how a government is treated globally. But it's a soft power instrument in a region defined by hard power realities.
Let me pivot to something Daniel's prompt implies, but doesn't state directly. If the League's primary visible output is anti-Israel statements, what does that function actually accomplish for the member states?
This is where it gets politically interesting. The anti-Israel function serves multiple purposes simultaneously. First, it provides a lowest common denominator issue on which every member state can agree. Sunni and Shia, monarchies and republics, rich Gulf states and poor states like Sudan or Yemen, they all disagree on almost everything, but criticizing Israel is the one issue that produces automatic consensus.
The diplomatic equivalent of ordering pizza because nobody can agree on a restaurant.
Like pizza, it's satisfying in the moment, but not exactly nourishing as a long-term diet. Second, it provides a pressure valve for domestic politics. If a government is facing internal criticism, economic problems, corruption, repression, convening an emergency Arab League session on Jerusalem or Gaza redirects public attention. It's the oldest play in the authoritarian handbook.
We're not solving unemployment, but look over there.
Third, it's a signal to Western powers. When the Arab League issues a statement on Israel, it's often aimed as much at Washington or Brussels as it is at the Israeli government. It's saying, we represent the collective Arab position, and you need to factor that into your calculations.
Whether or not the collective Arab position has any operational meaning.
And fourth, and this is the most uncomfortable part for Western observers, some of the anti-Israel rhetoric reflects genuine popular sentiment. The Arab League is not entirely disconnected from Arab public opinion. Polling consistently shows that the Palestinian issue resonates deeply with Arab publics, even if their governments are increasingly willing to normalize with Israel bilaterally.
Which creates an interesting tension. The Abraham Accords, the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, normalizing with Israel starting in 2020, those were bilateral deals that bypassed the Arab League entirely.
Completely bypassed it, and the League was conspicuously unable to stop them. There was an effort by the Palestinian Authority to get the League to condemn the Abraham Accords, and it failed. The League issued a watered-down statement that essentially said each member state makes its own decisions, which, by the League's own historical standards, was a remarkable abdication.
The League couldn't even hold the line on its one unifying issue.
because the member states that matter, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, have their own strategic interests that increasingly diverge from the Palestinian consensus position. Egypt has had a peace treaty with Israel since 1979 and coordinates closely with Israel on Gaza security. The Gulf states see Iran as the primary threat and Israel as a potential ally against Iran. The League's anti-Israel posture is increasingly a vestigial organ.
You're on a metaphor streak today.
The appendix of Arab diplomacy. It once served a purpose, now it mostly just gets inflamed periodically. But I want to circle back to something. We've been talking about what the League doesn't do, which is fair because that's most of the story, but I think we should acknowledge the things it does that don't make headlines. The League has a Department for Palestinian Affairs that administers some services in Palestinian refugee camps. It coordinates with UNRWA. It runs a number of health initiatives. The Arab Council for Health Specializations trains medical professionals across the region. The Arab League has a peace and security council that, while largely ineffective at conflict resolution, does conduct early warning monitoring. There's an Arab Parliament, a purely advisory body with no legislative power, but it exists as a forum for discussion.
An advisory body with no power. That's very on brand.
Completely on brand. There's also the Joint Arab Defense Council, established in 1950. It produced the Treaty of Joint Defense and Economic Cooperation, which is the closest thing the League has to a collective security framework. On paper, an attack on one member is an attack on all. In practice, this has never been meaningfully invoked in a way that produced collective action.
The paper security guarantee, the most common kind.
Here's a specific that I think illuminates the whole dynamic. In 2015, the Arab League announced the creation of a joint Arab military force. This was a major announcement, a 40,000-troop rapid reaction force to respond to regional crises. Egypt and Saudi Arabia were the main drivers. There were meetings, planning sessions, statements of commitment. It never materialized. The member states couldn't agree on command structure, rules of engagement, funding, or where it would be based. The joint force exists only in communiques, which is the Arab League in miniature, announced with fanfare, stalled on implementation, remembered only by researchers.
If I'm a cynical observer, and I am, it's part of my charm. I'd say the Arab League is essentially a talk shop that occasionally does useful technical work on the margins, but its core political function is to provide the appearance of Arab unity while masking deep divisions.
That's the cynical take, and it's largely accurate. But I want to push back on myself here because I think there's a more nuanced reading. The Arab League exists because the alternative, no pan-Arab institution at all, would be worse for everyone. Even a weak league provides a forum where adversaries can talk. During the Qatar diplomatic crisis of 2017 to 2021, when Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, and Egypt cut diplomatic ties with Qatar, the League was one of the few venues where all parties were still technically in the same room.
Technically in the same room is a very low bar for an international organization.
It's an extremely low bar. But in a region where conflicts can escalate rapidly, having a standing forum where communication channels exist is not worthless. It's not impressive, but it's not worthless.
The diplomatic equivalent of keeping the phone line connected, even if nobody's calling.
And there's one more thing worth mentioning. The Arab League has played a role in Lebanon's political crises. After the Lebanese Civil War, the League helped broker the Taif Agreement in 1989, which restructured Lebanon's political system and ended the war. That was a genuine diplomatic achievement.
1989. That was 37 years ago.
The highlight reel is short. But Taif shows that when the stars align, when the major member states agree, when the external powers are on board, when the crisis is severe enough, the League can be a useful diplomatic vehicle. It's just that those conditions rarely coincide.
The League is capable of achievement, but not reliable achievement. It's an instrument that works when the players want it to work and does nothing when they don't.
Which is true of most international organizations, to be fair. The United Nations is paralyzed when the Security Council permanent members disagree. The difference is that the UN has a massive operational bureaucracy that does things independently of Security Council politics, peacekeeping, refugee assistance, development programs. The Arab League doesn't have that independent operational capacity.
What's the counterfactual? If the Arab League didn't exist, would anything actually be different?
That's the killer question. I think, and I'm uncertain about this, the main difference would be the absence of a symbolic center of gravity for Arab political identity. The League embodies the idea that there is such a thing as an Arab world with shared interests. Without it, that idea would still exist, but it would have no institutional expression. Whether that matters practically is debatable, but symbolically it's significant.
Symbols matter in politics. The question is whether the symbol is worth the maintenance cost.
The maintenance cost is actually quite low in financial terms. The League's budget is minuscule compared to the GDP of its member states. The real cost is in the opportunity cost, the energy spent on League diplomacy that could be spent on bilateral or sub-regional cooperation that actually delivers results.
The political cost of maintaining an institution whose primary function is to issue statements nobody is bound by.
There's a credibility cost. When the Arab League condemns something for the 100th time and nothing happens, the 101st condemnation carries less weight. The League has cried wolf so many times on Israel that its statements on the subject are priced in. They move no markets, they change no policies.
Which actually undermines the Palestinian cause it claims to champion. If every statement is maximum intensity, no statement is maximum intensity.
The inflation of rhetoric devalues the currency. And I think some Arab diplomats understand this. There have been periodic efforts at reform, proposals to restructure the League to make it more effective, to introduce majority voting on certain issues, to create actual enforcement mechanisms. All of them have failed because reform requires consensus, and the states that benefit from a weak League block reforms that would strengthen it.
The states that benefit from a weak League.
Egypt benefits from a weak League because a strong League might be less Cairo-dominated. Saudi Arabia benefits because it prefers to operate through the GCC where its influence is greater. The smaller Gulf states benefit because a weak League can't pressure them on human rights or labor practices. Even the weaker states, Sudan, Yemen, Somalia, benefit in the sense that a weak League can't sanction them meaningfully. Everyone has a reason to prefer the status quo.
The dysfunction is a feature, not a bug. The League is designed to be exactly as ineffective as it is.
I wouldn't say designed. That implies more intentionality than I think existed. But it has evolved into an equilibrium where every member state gets something from the current arrangement and nobody gets enough to justify the political cost of changing it. It's an institutional Nash equilibrium.
The game theory of dysfunction. I appreciate that. So to answer Daniel's question directly, what does the Arab League actually do besides criticize Israel?
It provides a forum for diplomatic communication. It runs specialized agencies that do real technical work in education and health and development. It administers some Palestinian refugee services. It occasionally brokers political agreements when conditions align, and it serves as a symbolic expression of Arab political identity. It also issues thousands of non-binding resolutions on topics ranging from water resources to cultural cooperation to counterterrorism, most of which have no practical effect.
What is its purpose?
Its stated purpose is to strengthen relations among Arab states, coordinate their policies, and safeguard their independence. Its actual purpose is to provide the appearance of Arab unity while allowing member states to pursue their own interests with minimal constraint. It's a Potemkin institution, impressive from a distance, hollow up close.
Not entirely useless.
Not entirely useless. The translation programs are good. Alexo does solid work. The development funds have financed real infrastructure projects. And occasionally, very occasionally, the League does something like the Taif Agreement that justifies its existence for another decade.
It's a Potemkin institution with a library.
That's the most generous, accurate description I can give it.
I'll take it. One last question. Is there any plausible scenario where the Arab League becomes more effective?
Not without a fundamental restructuring that no current member state wants. The League would need majority voting, an enforcement mechanism, and a budget large enough to fund independent operations. That would require member states to cede sovereignty, which they won't do. The more likely trajectory is continued, irrelevance punctuated by periodic summits that produce communiques nobody reads.
Except the people who have to draft them.
Who are, I suspect, the true unsung heroes of this entire story.
And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1980s, researchers studying the tidal bore on China's Qiantang River measured water speeds of up to 40 kilometers per hour at the bore front, which, for American listeners accustomed to miles per hour, is nearly 25 miles per hour. That's faster than the average human can sprint, making it a wave that literally outruns anyone on foot.
A wave that outruns a sprinter? That's unsettling.
I now have a new thing to worry about that I didn't know existed 5 seconds ago.
Something to ponder. The Arab League is a case study in how institutions can persist for decades without achieving their stated goals, simply because no one has a better idea, and everyone's comfortable with the dysfunction. That's a dynamic worth watching far beyond the Middle East. Our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, makes this possible, along with the rest of our team. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you listen. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.